court will proceed to the fifth case for today, which is Osmagon versus Wells. Mr. Fry.
Good morning. My name is Eric Fry, and I represent the appellant who we're called Deli. I understand the court's difficulty in pronouncing his name. It is a difficult name.
I should have used the one you used in the brief, which was Deli.
He uses that in teaching, and I use it here today because, unfortunately, I can't pronounce it either. But my client, as you know from reading the record, is a citizen of Nigeria that was an assistant professor at Indiana State University, teaching in the African American Affairs Department, and was a tenure track appointment at that university when his tenure track appointment was terminated by the university.
Mr. Fry, I would like very much to sort out some of the procedural details of this case first so that we can zero in on what, as a matter of substance, is really before us. Because, as I believe you've argued, there are aspects of this case that seem pretty clearly to be barred by the 11th Amendment, such as the federal claim brought against ISU itself and the claim brought against these individual officials of ISU in their official capacity. Now, surely, as to those parties, under the jurisprudence of the Supreme Court, you would agree that the 11th Amendment is the end of the discussion. We don't need to talk about what the contract looks like. Well, indeed, we can't because of its jurisdictional quality, right?
Well, that's not correct if it's a state action, as this was.
Well, I'm going to try to separate out the federal claim brought against these people because you started out in state court.
That's correct.
Then you were removed to federal court. You had some federal claims that I'm suggesting to you look to me like they're 11th Amendment barred. There are some state claims you were bringing, presumably under the supplemental jurisdiction of the federal court. Now, in the Supreme Court's recent decision in Lapides against Board of Regents, it focuses very specifically on state law claims that as to which the state has waived its sovereign immunity for suits in state court, and it says that as for those, the act of removal to federal court constitutes a waiver of whatever 11th Amendment immunity there is. You would
correct.
Agree with that?
I agree with that, yes.
And then it leaves it pretty much up to the federal court what it wants to do with the 1367 jurisdiction, which as we know is discretionary, because actually in Lapides, like perhaps like part of this case, some the federal claims go away and they're left with nothing but the state claim. So I'm just, you know, trying in the logical sense to figure out what law governs which claims that are still before us. And it seems to me we can peel off the federal law claims against what's effectively the state, ISU and the official capacity claim.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Now, you might want to make an argument for us about whether the district court's decision to dismiss the individual capacity claims against Mr. Wells, Mr. Weisselman, and Ms. Blackshear Belay correct or not, because individual capacity claims can sometimes be brought depending on an ex parte Young theory. And you might want to talk about what evidence there is in this record that the state of Indiana has waived its sovereign immunity in state court for the kind of claim you're bringing, because I didn't see anything about that. But it seems to me we need to know what we really have here before we can do too much.
I agree with you, and it is a little confusing because the case was tried and summary judgment rendered before the Supreme Court's opinion in the Georgia case, and that that did complicate because it relied entirely on the 11th Amendment to dismiss or grant summary judgment on all claims in the trial record, and we think that was wrong because there is a contractual claim that was presented. There also are claims against the individuals that were presented that were swept away with this 11th Amendment argument that ISU made and the trial court adopted. We think that was error, particularly in light of Justice Breyer's opinion that came in May of 2002. There are also, we think, some issues that the trial court litigated or determined in the 11th Amendment that it really shouldn't have, because there are issues about whether or not there are federal claims that survive here or not. And we think
it's a very bizarre opinion in that, at least if the trial court believed what it was saying, part one is everything falls.
Everything falls in the 11th Amendment.
So there shouldn't have been a Part 2. I mean, there is a Part 2, but if the 11th, the 11th Amendment is jurisdictional. If you didn't have jurisdiction, you didn't have it, period.
Well, and if you read the Georgia case, it seems to me the contractual claim should have been, should now be sent back to state court where it started, because that's what should have happened in the beginning. That claim, it doesn't seem you can have pending jurisdiction inside the state court claims if you don't have federal jurisdiction, which is kind of what we're saying, I think, now under the Georgia case. Is
but in the Georgia case, though, the federal claims had fallen out on 11th Amendment grounds, and yet the court recognizes the continuing possibility of 1367 jurisdiction, which it says we don't want to rule on that. That's really something more properly given to the district court in its discretion. And the other thing about your case, which I suppose conceivably different, is if you still have a federal claim against the individuals in their individual capacity, you might still have a different argument about whether it's proper to retain under 1367 state claim.
I agree. I think it could be either way. And I think Justice Breyer kind of says that when he says the trial court might want to remand them to state court. He kind of encourages, I think, the judge to do that in the Lapidus case. He doesn't say it's required. I don't think he's really made a decision in his own mind, or the court had in its own mind, as to whether it's required or not. It's a relatively new issue, and we think it's not that clearly decided. Much like this question about, I think, the immigration issue we have in our cases is a very novel question, too. I couldn't find any law on that. As you can see in the record, Indiana State University sponsored this professor for immigration purposes, hired counsel, got him there, got his immigration status, and then terminated him. We contend that that does give rise to some kind of liberty right, a protection that he should be afforded that he wasn't given. ISU argued, and the trial court said, well, you know, there's really no development of this, there's no issue here, forget about it. Well, it isn't quite like an at-will employment like many of the cases we see are, because this person can't just go somewhere and work at another job if he's going to be deported.
He has no legally cognizable interest. Believe me, if you actually do delve into immigration law, it will curl your hair
when you
see what happens to people in the name of immigration law.
I understand that. I see that the time, except for my rebuttal time, is up. I would like to reserve about 3 minutes for rebuttal. Thank you.
Fine, Mr. Fry. Mr. Malley?
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is John Maley from Barnes & Thornburg in Indianapolis, representing the defendants' appellees, Indiana State University, and the three individuals, the provost, the dean, and the chair. Summary judgment on the merits should be affirmed for the defendants in this case.
But not on the 11th Amendment point,
We would agree with that, Your Honor. On the 11th Amendment points, there was, of course, the intervening decision from the Supreme Court.
But would you agree with me, then, that the case against ISU and the official capacity cases are the ones that are unequivocally barred by the 11th Amendment at a minimum? I mean, I suppose you have an argument also for the individual capacity case?
That's correct, Your Honor.
But why on that? I wanted to ask you why you think it makes any difference on the individual capacity case that there might be some side agreement. I'll just take Mr. Wells as an example. I don't mean to pick on anybody. But if the plaintiff were to obtain an individual capacity verdict against Mr. Wells, what it would say is Mr. Wells has to pay the plaintiff X dollars. That's all it would say. And that would be Mr. Wells' responsibility. Now, whether he then turns around and gets the X dollars through some side indemnity agreement, which certainly exists in many instances, but they don't exist everywhere, or whether he has an insurance policy, or whether he just has to mortgage his house and pay, and, you know, these are momentous things for the individuals involved. But I don't see where that converts an individual capacity case into a case against the state.
Your Honor, in Indiana State University and within the state of Indiana, the practice is to indemnify, and
well,
that seems to be where the...
That's true in many places, and I think your argument would have the effect of sweeping away virtually every ex parte Young theory there is. I've never seen the Supreme Court say one of the criteria for bringing an ex parte Young action is proof on the plaintiff's part that there's no indemnity agreement. Do you know of any cases that
I do not,
that?
Your Honor. The decisions do use the language that if the claim is part and parcel of what the actor here, for instance, the provost, is engaged in, is part and parcel of the employer, then they have been accorded the 11th Amendment immunity. Fortunately, in this case, Judge Young went ahead and addressed the merits, as he should have. The court should have done that, because there were still the reinstatement claims that would potentially be available. And fortunately, we have on appeal now, even after the Supreme Court's decision that swept away some of the 11th Amendment issues, we have a very clear, simple, routine employment case, much like 10 years ago this court confronted in the Colburn versus Indiana University case, where you have a very simple set of facts with a pre-tenure, probationary assistant professor on a year-to-year contract. Serve the year, you get reviewed during the year, and you either get invited back or not. And of course, the general criteria are, as they are at most universities, publishing and research, teaching and service.
Mr. Malley, I hate to harp on this, though, but I don't know, even if you're right about how easy the merits are, the Supreme Court has told us we can't reach merits unless we're sure we have jurisdiction.
Absolutely, Your Honor.
And the thing that concerns me about some of the plaintiff's state law theories here is I don't know on this record whether if this whole thing had stayed in the state court, maybe he never brought any federal issues, maybe he just brought a state contract action against ISU, whether this record or whether you can tell me whether the state of Indiana has waived its sovereign immunity for that kind of contract claim. Being quite frank with you, I have no idea if they have or not.
Certainly. The state has not, as a matter of statute, waived that sovereign immunity.
That would mean a different result under the Lapidate decision then, wouldn't it?
Certainly, Your Honor, because the state claim, the Lapidate decision addressed the state law claims. So those would, the removal of that claim to federal court under the Lapidate decision did waive that immunity.
No, what Justice Breyer says is we're looking at the state law claims that were covered by a waiver of state sovereign immunity in state court. That's a very important part of his ruling. And in that instance, it was the Tort Claims Act of Georgia, which was the statutory waiver. But if there is no such statutory waiver of the state sovereign immunity back when it was in state court, it seems to me at least a possible interpretation of Lapidate that we also have no jurisdiction because the 11th Amendment would continue to protect the state. And that's my worry about jumping into the merits too quickly.
I understood, Your Honor. As I interpreted Lapidate, and I may be interpreting it differently than Your Honor, that the mere removal constituted the waiver, that when we removed on behalf of the defendants to federal court, that we now under the Supreme Court standard committed waiver. But there's still, even with the 11 men and issues, the district court needed to address, and fortunately did address, the merits. And needed to because the 11th Amendment did not take care of everything, even pre-Lapidus decision. So you have then, again, a very simple Colburn case where this faculty member, who, by the way, in the 2 years that he was at Indiana State University, published a grand total of two works. One was a two-page, and this is in the record, his CV attached to his affidavit opposing summary judgment. One was a two-page book review. One was a six-page article. The dean of the College of Arts and Sciences said repeatedly in writing, told the plaintiff this, told the provost this, the provost agreed, said he had grave concerns about his teaching. That's, of course, the stuff of universities, of what they do and how they assess whether someone should stay on board. If they had decided to reappoint this individual for a third year, it de facto meant a fourth year, because the longer you stay under that system, you have to get notice now 12 months before the year starts. And that was one of the things that the dean pointed out in his reasoning when he determined this is the time to make this decision. It's not an easy decision. It's discretionary. It's business judgment. Indiana State University made that decision. And it's not the province of this court, as this court says time and again, to sit as a super personnel department and second-guess the employer's legitimate decision. The due process claim fails because there's no property interest. He had a right to a one-year employment. He received that one-year employment. He was then offered a second year conditionally, which is, of course, not a good thing to have, conditional employment. But it's better than no employment. He did not, in the judgment of the dean, in the judgment of the provost, in the judgment of the university, improve to where they should keep him on. He has no property interest that he can point to that allowed him to anything more than that additional year. So come May of 2000, the conclusion of his second calendar, his second school year at Indiana State University, He'd been notified back in December of 1999 that he would not be reappointed, and in fact, then he was not reappointed. Now, the immigration issue that apparently plaintiff has tried to develop, and really has not developed, there's one scant paragraph in plaintiff's opening brief devoted to this issue without any citation of legal authority. The only legal authority on this point ever cited by plaintiff was this court's decision in a deportation case. This is not a deportation case. The university, as it must do, filled out, sponsored an I-140 form. In immigration law, that simply means this person now is employed here. It's proof to the INS that this person is employed. The form, and this is in the record attached to the plaintiff's affidavit, the INS form then says, you, plaintiff, you individual, now need to go fill out your application for permanent residency. The record's silent as to whether he's done that or not. Presumably he has, because he's still a plaintiff in this case. Presumably he's still here in the United States. That's up for him to do. Indiana State University did not deport him, simply made a legitimate job decision within their discretion, within their business judgment. And there's been no showing, no record developed, no argument developed to the contrary. So this case is controlled by the Colburn decision, such as it's a routine decision, much as the district court found, although there are those interesting 11th Amendment issues. Once you get beyond those, on the merits, summary judgment should be affirmed by this court. The state law contract claim, which the court was well within its supplemental jurisdiction under Section 1367 of Title 28 to retain, and in fact it made sense because the state law claim, breach of contract, is essentially the same facts and issues as the property interest claim. The property interest under Roth, under Colburn, come out of either state statutes or ordinances or contracts. The court found no contract beyond the 1 year. So the state law claim, it's appropriate for the district court, and now this court, to confirm, as it can affirm under any basis, that the state law breach of contract claim should be affirmed as well and dismissed with prejudice, because there's no sense going back now and having another court, whether it's Judge Young in Terre Haute or a state judge in Indiana, readdressing what Judge Young already went through, looking at the facts of his contract, the facts of how he was treated. So respectfully, Your Honor, on the merits of this case should be affirmed. It's a routine case governed by Supreme Court precedents such as Roth and by this court's own decision in Colburn. No further questions, though. Thank you for your time, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Mr. Fry?
Just a few other points I'd like to make. We believe this is not a simple employment case, as Mr. Maley argues. The reason for that is the Colburn case had a very subjective standard. This court noted that about what the university evaluates to decide whether to keep a good or bad professor. This is a contract. It's a very clearly written contract that was accepted by Delhi, and it said that he would be reviewed for tenure based and with a positive evaluation recommendation will be eligible for tenure at the beginning of 2005-06. Continuation during the probationary period is based on annual faculty evaluation. The record shows he was evaluated four times. All four times it was recommended he be kept in his appointment. The people who made the decision that Mr. Maley mentions, the faculty chairperson, the dean, and the provost, never observed his teaching methods, knew nothing about his teaching abilities, and really had no part in the evaluation process. That's clear in the record below, too. So we think there is a very substantive issue here about whether or not he met the contract requirement to keep his position. That was that he received faculty evaluations that were positive, because they were positive. We're not asking this court to say, put your mind or some other court to put its mind in the faculty's position whether he's a good or bad professor. We're simply looking at the black letter of the agreement ISU made. And in Colburn, this court said, if there's a clear standard, yeah, we can follow that, but we're not going to substitute our judgment for faculties and staff and make decisions about who's doing the job and who's not. But this said, if he got annual evaluations that are acceptable, he's kept. And he did. He got all four, even two of them handpicked by his nemesis here, the chairperson who was trying to get rid of him. She picked non-people in his department, people outside his department to evaluate him. They said keep him. So we believe he met the black letter requirements of the contract, and that's clear. When you've got that, you should have a property interest. And we don't think Judge Young had a chance to flesh that out here at all, because he was so preoccupied at ISU's request with the 11th Amendment issue, he just said, I have no jurisdiction here, I have nothing to do here, everything fails, the 11th Amendment bars any action by anybody over anything. And that's obviously error. We think because of that, the court has to either look at this case and say either there was no federal claim here, so it ought to be a state court contract question, which ought to be decided, we think, in state court, because Section 1367 shouldn't apply if there's no jurisdiction at all. It ought to be, as Justice Breyer said, it probably ought to be sent back to state court by the district court. This court can do that instead. If there is a federal case here, we believe there's one where there's a substantial contract question that's a part of a 1367 case that wasn't fleshed out and decided. We also think the immigration issue wasn't fully developed and fleshed out because of the 11th Amendment as well. The trial court was so preoccupied. If you look at its order, most of the discussion is about the 11th Amendment. It's just entirely an 11th Amendment case. That's not the way it should have been. If you're going to bar this person from having a claim to be presented, it ought to be based on an opportunity to present his evidence. And that really wasn't done because the argument in the trial court was about the 11th Amendment. And after the recent decision, obviously, that argument didn't need to take place because that's now clearly decided, and it wasn't there. It really was more decided there, we thought, than the trial court did. But now we know exactly how it's decided. I see my time is up. I thank you for your time today.
Thank you, Mr. Fry. Thanks to both counsel. The case will be taken under advisement.